Accession number 29054, Mr. Bim Wells, Reel 4. Now, take me through, and well, firstly, let's think, what did you think of your instructor? Because this is going to be an important man to you over the next couple of weeks.
Dick Reap, his name was.
What was he like? What did you think of your instructor?
Well, I got on well with him. He was helpful, and
Did he have the sort of confident attitude and flying skills that gave you confidence?
He didn't sort of yell at me. He quietly told me what I was doing wrong. I mean, you do sort of basic taxiing for a start, and then basic turns, sort of following him through, if you like, for a start. And
what was he taking? What's the program? What do they teach you first?
Normal left and right turns.
In the air, of course.
In the air, taxiing on the ground, and landings. You eventually go on the landings, but you then are taught how to stall the aircraft, you know, by pulling the nose up and then letting it drop down and this sort of thing. And after you've done about how many hours? About 10 hours, you have a check with another instructor.
Now, what? They're just checking that you're online, that you can do what you're supposed to do.
That you're making progress, basically. And the system was, you either had an up check or a down check. And if you had three down checks, you were out. And I didn't do very well on my first couple.
Now, what problems were you having?
The landing, basically. I was bouncing.
Heavy landings?
Yeah.
Were you coming in too fast or at the wrong angle?
I think a bit too fast, really. The first check is given to you by your own instructor, this Dick Reap chap. And he said, I'm sorry, Wells, I'm going to have to give you a down check, you see, because your landings aren't good. The rest of your work is all right. And then you have another check with another American instructor, and my luck would have it that way. I got a chap named, they called him Down Check Morgan. And he down checked more people than he up checked, and of course I got him, and I was a bit nervous, and I got another down check. So I thought, one more and I'm out. And I then got another instructor who I got on quite well with, and he gave me an up check, and so I was then on the way a bit, and then damn me, I got another down check. And so I've got one more chance, and I got an up check on the next one. So I'm then allowed to go on my first solo flight. On
now, what have you? What are the basic controls in the cockpit of the NS2 N2S? N2S. I mean, what sort of aircraft? What's the layout of the cockpit?
It's you've got the joystick, obviously, and the power control. There were no things. It was just a basic training aircraft. There was no sort of propeller pitch you could alter.
So the joystick, that would control you in which way? Just explain.
Well, the joystick, you've got the foot pedals to work the ailerons, and the joystick.
And that moves in which way? What does that control?
The ailerons, take you up or down. The joystick, you've got to coordinate the ailerons with the joystick when you're doing a turn. Otherwise, you lose height or this sort of thing. And it's all a question of coordination. A lot of it, yeah. So anyway.
So what was your first solo like?
I got on ever so well, really. They had a number of satellite airfields, Do you want a drink of... Well, I took off from Grose Hill and you went out to one of these satellite grass airfields where there were several other training people, you know, and in fact, I just rehash on that. They actually took you out to an outlying satellite airfield in a bus, closed bus. Because I always remember I was feeling a bit nervous about doing this on my own for the first time, and there was a chap sitting at the top end of the bus with his flying helmet on one side and smoking a fag, looking extremely confident. And I got talking to him, and it turned out he lived at Loughborough, and we'd played football and cricket against one another, it turned out, and he was going out on his second solo, so he said, "Oh, it's a piece of cake, like, you know." Anyway, we got to this satellite airfield, and I got in this aircraft and took off and flew around a bit and landed it. And
what was it like, first time being completely on your own up there?
Wonderful, wonderful. We were quite close to a Ford, of course, Detroit. They had a big factory there called Willow Run, where they used to build Liberator bombers, and one of these bombers used to come. It was you could see it from the air. It was an enormous long factory thing, and they used to roll off one of these Liberator bombers one every hour, you know. Amazing place it was. But these N2Ss, although they've got a 220 horsepower, if you got a headwind and you looked at the floor, you were sometimes going backwards instead of forwards, you know. But we used to land on these satellite airfields, and there were perhaps 20 other chaps on the first solo, and you know, used to get out the aircraft and just leave it ticking over. One chap left his propeller going a bit too fast, and suddenly the aircraft was running across the field, and it went into the hedge, and he got put on a charge for that. But once I got over that first solo, I never looked back. And the next stage was you went up with your instructor, and they had these fields with like a big circle in white paint. Wasn't very far across, probably about 20 or 30 feet, and the instructor would suddenly cut the engine, and you'd got to glide round and land in this circle. And I was very good at that. I found it no problem at all. And
that's just practicing emergency landings, I presume.
Well, yeah, it was. And you know, we started doing a bit of aerobatics and this sort of thing.
Tell us, I don't know whether you still remember, take us through some of the aerobatics you learned and how you did them, because people don't know now, and some of them, like sidestepping, you're not allowed to do now, I believe.
One of the most frightening things from my point of view was when the instructor took me up on my first aerobatics, was he put it into what's called an inverted spin. Now, an inverted spin, you sort of go into a loop, and when you get to the top of the loop, upside down, you push the stick forwards and stall the engine, and you're then going in an inverted spin as opposed to a forward spin. And I was literally hanging out of the aircraft on these straps, and my knees were sort of under my chin. And he said something about recovery. Well, I couldn't get my feet up to the pedals. And he said, well, the secret is you hang on to your seat when it goes into invert with one hand. And to get out of an inverted spin, what you do in a forward spin is you give it opposite rudder and push the stick forward. And an inverted spin, you pull the stick back and it comes out of it sort of that way. But the first time he put me into an inverted spin frightened me to death. You know, just to be hanging out upside down out of an aircraft just on the straps was a bit of a frightening experience, I must admit. And anyway, at the end of...
Now, what other aerobatics did they do? I mean, was there any looping or barrel rolls or rolling or anything like that?
You did a slow roll. You did
now,
what
how do you do a slow roll?
Well, you turn completely round like that, and you've got to work the ailerons and the joystick so that you don't lose too much height when you're doing it. Otherwise,
so you turn on your sort of own axis as you're going along.
And we used to do a thing called a falling leaf.
Where now, I don't know what's that one.
Well, you pull the nose of the aircraft up until it stalls, and then it drops that way and that way. Rather like a falling leaf, and you've got to recover from that. Loop the loop, of course, you did.
Now, what's that like to actually do it? Is it scary or?
I found it very. I enjoyed doing that. You know, you've got the speed. You go up and all the way around, like, but you never sort of come out on the straps as it was, because you're going round all the time. It's when they stall it on the top of the loop, then. You do what was an old World War manoeuvre called the Immelmann turn.
Now, how do you do that? I mean, well, that's quite common.
You go into a loop, and on the top of the loop, when you're upside down, you roll the aircraft over and come on up flying the right way up. That's the Immelmann turn. I mean, the main reason, Immelmann was a German, of course, who devised this manoeuvre, but the main idea of it was to gain height. Because you went up in the loop and then it rolled out on the top, and you were higher than where you started, if you see what I mean. Anyway.
Any other? So that's enough acrobatics. So anything else you were learning during these dual? You know, after your first solo, the sort of dual.
You did these side slips as well.
Now, what is a side slip? Because people don't understand that either.
Well, it's a way of losing height, basically, particularly when you're trying to get into this circle. You sort of kick the rudder bar, and the aircraft, instead of going, slips down like that. That's a side slip, and you can right it. So you can lose height quite quickly, rather than without losing, without gaining too much airspeed, you lose height. If you just stick joystick forward, you gain speed very quickly, of course, but with a side slip you don't, and it was a way of losing height without having too much
so you speed. Could get down to a specific point without speeding up. Now anything else you're doing during the dual? Were you still having checks, which I presume you were passing?
Well, yeah. At the end of this, your first solo, after you've done so much, you have another check. You have a check at each stage. And on the second stage, straight through, up check first time, and I'm on to the next stage. Where you're doing things like, well, I'd mentioned inverted spin and snap rolls, loops, slips to landings, snap rolls, all these sort of things. Again, you start off doing it with your instructor the first hour and a half or something, and then you're on your own doing these things. And you're still doing these landing into the circle by cutting the engine and this sort of thing.
Oh, now, would you be flying
Immelmann turn? I didn't mention that, yeah.
Would you be flying a lot with him, or would you be going up on your own mostly, or was it a mixture?
About every third flight you were with the instructor. He was just checking how you were getting on. And the other two or three times you were on your own. And this next section...
What about on the ground? Were you doing any stuff on... any more navigation stuff or any more stuff on engines or how an aeroplane works?
Well, yes,
theory
you were.
Of flying,
you were, yeah.
Where did you do that at?
This was at Gros Eel, of course. You had a certain amount of instruction on the ground in the sort of classroom, aircraft recognition, this sort of thing. British and American and Japanese aircraft as well at that stage.
Now, how did they do aircraft recognition? I mean, was it just I mean, what was it, diagrams or models or films or what was it?
It was mainly pictures at that stage. Later on in my training, it got I wouldn't say more difficult, but more intense. When I got to the next stage of my flying training, when I got down to Florida.
Now, what about what about learning the theory of flying? Did you do much of that? Lectures on, you know, what kept the airplane, how the wings work?
Yes, you did. About the design of the wing to give the lift that the aircraft needs and this sort of thing, and about the functions of ailerons and this sort of thing, and rudders, and you were taught all this, certainly.
And what about engines? Anything about the engines, or was that just left out?
No, you were taught about how the engine worked and the propeller and you know, the American aircraft were mainly radial engines, which is where the pistons are round in a circle, as opposed to the inline engine, like the Merlin, for instance. The Americans mainly use radial engines made by Pratt & Whitney and Wright Cyclone. They were the main sources of power.
Okay.
As I say, I then got through the next stage. I got a down check for a start, and then followed that by two up checks. And I was we started doing a bit of formation flying at that
now
stage.
Now tell me about that. What are the skills you need in formation flying? Because I understand it's pretty difficult when you start it, unless you're lucky.
It is. You can get throttle happy, as it were. You know.
Now what does that mean? What do you mean by that?
Well, you're forever sort of moving the throttle forward and backwards to stay in position. As you get further on in your training, you get more skilled at it. And you can get it so your throttle setting keeps you in position sort of exactly without having to muck about with the throttle at all. It gets a bit more difficult when you start doing turns in formation, but the basic formation flying, again, I took to quite well, really. And
now, what about gunnery? Any gunnery, or is this not something that's going on at the moment? There's shooting. I mean, you weren't practicing firing or anything at this stage.
Not at this stage, no. We were doing sort of turns round pylons, a little bit of cross-country flying.
And tell me about that. What cross-country, that would involve some navigation, I presume. Well, how long, what type of cross-country flights are you
going? Well, at this stage in your in your training, you didn't do a great deal. It was you did formation flying. You even did takeoffs in formation as well in the latter stages. And but it was basically just learning how to fly an aeroplane all this time. I think you did a bit of towards the end, a bit of night flying even.
Now tell me, what was that like?
Bit scary the first time you do it. In fact, one of the chaps in our block crashed into Lake Erie, into the ice, and that was the end of him. A chap named Bill Summers, I remember, and that was a bit of a rude awakening to us, if you like, that flying can be dangerous, you know. But
I mean, could you see at night in one of these things? I mean, could you see what you were doing?
Well, of course, in America, there was no restriction on lights. You could see roads and towns and this sort of thing.
What about your instruments? Were they lit or backlit? Or?
Yes, they were lit. They were lit. But, I mean, you got an altimeter and a temperature gauge. They were fairly basic in the N2S. You, as I say, you got the throttle and the joystick and
pedals. Did you find night flying difficult, or was it just you worried about it and then it was okay when you did it? Or
I don't know. It was all an adventure at that stage of it, you know. It was training, and I just took to it, really.
You enjoyed it?
Yeah.
And what about on the ground? What was life like on the ground? when you weren't flying?
We were a bit shocked, in a way, at the stiffness of the American discipline.
In what way? Tell us about that.
Well, you had to make your beds. We were in, like, dormitories, two-tier bunk beds, and you had to make your bed and turn it down. And this American lieutenant used to come round, and he used to bounce a dime on your bed, and if it didn't shoot up a certain height, you were on a charge. And I mean, we used to counter their discipline by, as it were, having a bit of fun with them. And we developed what we called a tiddly change step. You know, when you're marching and they say change step, and you just do a click of the heels and change step. We used to go one forward, one right, one left, and the skip, and do it that way. And we used to get about 20 or 30 of us who all knew how to do this tiddly change step, and we used to march down the road at Gros Hill, and then whoever was in charge used to say, right lads, tiddly change step, you see. And it looked great when they all did it together, and the Americans thought that was the way the Royal Navy did change step, but we never did tell them. So
was there much nightlife? I mean, was there anywhere to go in Gros Hill?
Well, we used to go into Detroit.
Is the island attached? I mean, is it an island? Or
it is an island. There's bridges across. I've got a...
So what was the night out like in Detroit?
Well, for a start, they wouldn't let us go into Detroit because they were having terrible race riots in Detroit at that time.
Now, what did you know about that? I mean, what did you find
not
out?
Not a lot, really. But I mean, there was there was arson and shooting and God knows what, and they would not let us go into Detroit for about a month. We used to have dances on the base, and they'd flooded an area and made it an ice skating rink, and I learned how to ice skate on this rink, and they had cinema shows and this sort of thing. And there were a few waves about. The waves are the equivalent of our wrens. But they did eventually let us go into Detroit.
Now, what was it like in Detroit?
Well, we went to the USO, which is like our, what do they call the British thing? Where there were invites out to American families and this sort of thing. And they put on sort of variety shows. I remember seeing, she never did make much of a name for herself, but a film star called Gail Storm. How on earth she got a name like that, I don't know, but I just remember the name Gail Storm. And we saw her at this USO thing, and she was a bit of a cracker, I must admit. And
this USO
the other thing we used to do is we used to stop the night there. And we used to go to this hotel, and two of the lads would book a room, and it finished up with about 20 of us sleeping in this room, some on the bed, some on the floor. So we only paid for one room with about 20 of us. You learn these sort of things.
Would you go to the bars? What was the Detroit bars like?
Yes, we used to go to the bars, and of course by... the Americans were in the war by this time, and often when you went into a bar, you couldn't drink until you were 21 in America at that time. And of course, they used to ask you for your paybook to see your date of birth. And mine was 1924, and this was, I was 19 at the time. So, with a razor blade, I made the four into a one. So it made it 1921. And, I think they knew we weren't 21, but they gave us a drink. And we often, several times, we used to go to the bar, and the barman say, "Lady and gentleman over there would like to buy you a drink, sir." And these Americans used to buy us drinks. And I met a girl there as well, and I used to go out with her a bit, and another friend of mine, and I was still a bit naive about girls at that time, because I remember she took me back to her, well, she lived with her sister and her husband, and my wife's not listening to this, and I remember her saying, we were sitting on this settee and we're getting a bit, you know, close to one another, and she said, don't worry about my brother and sister, they're both deaf. And I didn't take the hint. But what she was really saying was inviting me, you know, to have sex with her, I think. And but I never did.
Did you get on well with him?
The funny thing is that this particular girl, she wrote to my mother, and this chap who I'd mentioned, who passed out when they saw the colour film on VD, Dame Gam Walker, he dipped at Gross Hill. In other words, he didn't, and he was sent home. And when he came home, he went to see my mother, and she said, I've had this very nice letter from this lady in Detroit, you see. And she thought it was a sort of middle-aged woman who'd take me in, like. And of course, Gam Walker perhaps said, oh no, she's only about 70, he said. but there you are.
Did you like the American civilians? I mean, did you get on well? Did they like
you? I did, yeah. I got on well with them, yeah. Of course, we had we were into American food as well. And they used to have things in the mess like sauerkraut, which I frankfurters and sauerkraut was one of their staples, and I couldn't take to that. But I mean, when you went to breakfast, these mainly American Negroes were sort of the cooks and the servers, and they used to say, "How's your want your eggs, boss?" You see, and you used to say, "Oh." Sunny side up, or once over lightly, or and this sort of thing. But I remember we were at Gross Hill when it was Thanksgiving Day, and we had a hell of a feast that day with the old turkey and everything like that. I've still got, I think, the menu in my scrapbook somewhere, but I do remember we had a hell of a feast there at Thanksgiving, because Thanksgiving's November time, isn't it?
Now, what about the final? I mean, how does the course come to an end, or does it come to an end?
You know, well, yes, it comes to an end, and you have a sort of final checkout.
Now, what is the final checkout? What is the sort of testing program?
I'm just trying to. You do all sorts of things like formation flying, cross unders and crossovers, which is a fairly dangerous exercise. You've got to cross over the other plane and get, you know, you've got somebody flying as leader and you've got two aircraft flying either side of him, and the ones either side have got to do this crossover movement so that you change places, and you it's not an easy operation, particularly when you're not that experienced. So and there were one or two people who had crashes. We had one or two people lose their lives. One of them flew into the control tower, and other people, as I say, the chap who crashed into Lake Erie at night. And
now, how did you
most of the time, as I say, you are doing, by this time, doing mainly solo stuff. And I think we started doing link trainer, which was the where you sit in like an aircraft cockpit and you do a navigation exercise, flying purely on instruments.
What did you think of the link trainer? How realistic was it? How much use was it? And how real? You know, people don't know what they are now.
It's a funny experience because you're completely enclosed. You can't sort of see where you're going or anything, and you're asked to fly on this sort of triangular course, if you like. For you set off on one course for so long, and then you do a 90 or 120 degree turn to starboard, and then fly on that course for so long. And of course, it's all being tracked on one of these sort of things, which you can't see. And by the time you get to the end of your triangular course, they release the hood and you go and see what sort of job you've made of doing this instrument flying. But it teaches you how to rely on instruments, basically. They've got the horizon thing in a link trainer, which tells you your attitude of your aircraft, whether you're flying one wing low, or whether you're diving, or whether you're climbing, this sort of thing. But it certainly teaches you how to fly on instruments and keep flying at certain speeds, which you have to. I didn't particularly enjoy link trainer, but I suppose it was part of the training.
Realistic enough?
Yeah, it was.